Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a spectacular show for you this evening. We are 1 week away from Air Venture 2024 at Oshkosh, and John Uzekai, President and CEO of Aspen Avionics, is here for a sneak preview of the show, an update of things to come, and just have a great time as usual when we get together to chat. It's going to be a ton of fun. You get to know everything new happening at Aspen Avionics. And I have to say, I absolutely love it when John comes on the show. Now, before we get started, just a few things. First of all, Social Flight is booming right now, so get out there and check that out. We have thousands of events, destinations, our FAA learning system, Wings AMT courses, IA renewals. It is all in Social Flight. And we also just launched our Destination Digest, which you can see right here. This is a personalized aviation adventure planner. It's delivered straight to your inbox with incredible places to fly, things to do, crew cars, more. It's all from socialflight.com. And you can just go there or go to the mobile app, search and find all of that for yourself. And if that weren't enough, our Fly to Win challenge is going on and getting ready to wrap up on August 1st. And we are giving away an Aspen E5 electronic flight instrument. All you need to do to win that prize is just to go get out there and fly using the Social Flight mobile app, check in at even your home airport, and you are entered in to win. If you fly and check in at multiple airports, get on our leaderboard, well, then you're going to get multiple entries into that drawing. And I absolutely love the E5. Be sure to get out there and check that out. And of course, tonight's broadcast is brought to you by Aspen Avionics and the amazing Evolution Max and E5 electronic flight instruments. We have both an Evolution 1000 Pro Max primary flight display in our Bonanza, as well as an Evolution 1000 MFD Max. And I'm going to show you some pictures a little later on in the broadcast, but we absolutely love flying behind that panel. Makes our IFR flying safer and easier. And we are even installing another Pro Max PFD in that Mustang sitting right there behind me that you'll also be seeing pretty soon. So on to tonight's program. Aspen Avionics President and CEO John Uzekai has over 40 years of experience in the avionics industry. He is someone who has also spent decades in that world. I worked with him for some time of that, and I can tell you firsthand that he is truly respected and admired by everyone who has had the pleasure of working with him. His resume includes such iconic names as Boeing, Sperry, Honeywell, names that give him exactly the tools needed to lead Aspen Avionics. John received the Aviation Industry Entrepreneur of the Year Award in 2012 and was inducted into the Living Legends of Aviation in 2013. He is a member of the Board of Directors for the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, or GAMA. As you might expect, he is also an instrument-rated private pilot. I am very fortunate to call him a friend and thrilled to have him here tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, John Uzekai. Hey there, John.
Hey, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the kind words. I really appreciate it. It's always a fun to join you on this program.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to join us here and for everything that you do there at Aspen. It's you're celebrating 20 years, as I understand it, of history at Aspen. And I feel like in one way or in another, I've watched it from the very beginning, and it just puts such a smile on my face.
Well, I appreciate that, Jeff. I mean, we talked to you for many, many years at the beginning. It's amazing 20 years have gone by, to be quite honest with you. In a lot of ways, when I left, larger corporations, I took this job primarily because I wanted to fly more, and I really enjoyed the avionics part of it. And you were there in the early days and had a lot to do with a lot of discussions and stuff we had in the very beginning of the company. And 20 years is a long time. It's actually the longest place I've worked in my career, which is an interesting fact that I keep reminding myself of. And it's by far been the funnest job I've ever had.
I have to tell you, I literally remember the moment that I saw the first Aspen EFD product. I remember what hangar you were in. I remember where I was walking when I saw it. I remember the big company I was working for at the time when I saw that and went, oh man, like that was like all of a sudden everything before that was big, expensive. The installation time was 2 to 3 times the cost of the product that was already expensive. And when I saw all of a sudden it was like, nope, you just slide this right into place where the six pack goes. I remember turning the person next to me and saying, that's a game changer.
Yeah. And so, you know, what's interesting about that, we like to think that we kind of started the bit of the revolution in terms of bringing glass panels into the cockpits. And you've seen many people now join that fray and the different companies and including the big players as well as the small players and new entrants. And, you know, I've always believed very strongly that competition is really, really good for our industry, especially in general aviation, because the only way you drive down costs is competition. I mean, you know, people, you know, that we all try to make money as companies. But one way to keep everybody in tow is having a lot of competition. So when we first came out, you know, it was new. It was a new thought, a new idea, a novel way to put it in. But more importantly, it spurred a lot of innovation by us and other companies to bring these safety enhancing technologies to the forefront. And I think that's one of the things I'm most proud of, is that we brought a new era of technology into general aviation. And it spurred a lot of competition, a lot of new players, and will continue to do so, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. I have this sneak peek of going back in time. Tell me a little bit about... got a couple of pictures to show here.
This picture was was 2007 at our very first time we announced our product, and you alluded to in your introductory comments. It was probably the most exciting time for us when we really brought things out. We weren't sure exactly how things were going to be taken. We weren't sure how people were going to look, whether skepticism would be there. It was a year before certification, so there was a lot of skepticism that we could certify, but it was a really fun time. And this was at the initial press conference, this picture right here, and I have real fond memories of it. That was really a lot of fun.
And there's Mr. Paul Berensi there, of course.
Yeah. Tom was a great supporter of the idea of what we were trying to do. And he did a lot in encouraging us both privately and publicly in that way. He always came out to our press conferences. He always came out to our North 40 tent. I think he really believed that the revolution of bringing electronic display and other technologies into the low end of GA all the way up was going to be a game changer. And he was a great advocate, and he was a great man.
I've got another one here. This, who's this young man at the up at the podium?
Yeah, a lot less gray hair, right? Yeah, I will tell you, that picture, we were a little bit shocked by how many people showed up. Yeah,
I was at that press conference.
Yeah, I know. When we showed up, it was like, wow, that's a lot of people, because we were a no-name company, right? I mean, nobody really knew about us. This is where we rolled out the product. This is where we talked about it. The attendant, I remember being shocked and said, oh my goodness, this is a lot of people here. I better not screw up. So it was a fun time.
And the booth.
Yes. So, you know, those of you, if that ever remembered, we were in a single wide booth just in the middle of one of the hangars. We were nervous that what the traffic would be. We were stunned how busy we were. We were exhausted after the first day, and we were thinking, oh my gosh, we got more days of this. But it was fun, and people were excited. They were asking questions. They wanted to know their aircraft would fit. It was just a lot of fun. But I remember being very exhausted after the first day, thinking, yeah, how am I going to make it through the whole week?
I love that you showed a cutaway. You showed what the technology actually was that was inside the can there.
Yeah, people were very intrigued by that, because you got to remember, in 2007, the concept of having electronics of that size, you know, remember, iPads weren't prolific, watches weren't prolific. It wasn't usual to have AHARs like technology or GPS technology that small, and putting it into that form factor create a lot of challenges for it. But back then, the electronics, that was really at the forefront, and so people were very intrigued by it and really wanted to touch it and see it.
Yeah, it's fun to kind of reminisce back, and of course Jack as well.
Yeah, so actually, it's one of my favorite pictures of Rosie Jack. Jack and I go way back to the McDonnell Douglas Boeing days. Knew Jack when he was at Dornier and at Cessna. We're close friends, and Rose and Jack have been close friends of mine, almost my entire career. It's just great to see what he's done at EAA, and it's one of the things I look forward to being at the show, is seeing both of them.
Mm-hmm. That is truly wonderful. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the evolution of this, because it really brings us nicely up to the kind of talking about later on what's new and what's coming. Mm-hmm. You mentioned about how competition drives costs down, is good for everyone, drives innovation. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about what's involved in that from your perspective, because I think people think about it sometimes only with cost when they think about that. But in our world, in the world of avionics and for general aviation, without that competition, you're not driving interoperability, you're not driving warranties, you're not driving support, things where products get made obsolete and you just have to buy something else. Mm-hmm. I think that you guys have set a standard, in my opinion, for staying with a product and making it upgradable, that I want to hear about what it was like from the inside to get there.
So, we kind of touched on who we're about. So, first of all, being cost conscious is normal. It's expected, right? I mean, when you're doing your airplane, I mean, I own an airplane too, and have owned airplanes, and cost is a big part of it. And you're looking at trade-offs in everything you do. How much am I going to spend on display? Do I want an autopilot? Do I want to do my interior? Do I want to do lights? All those things are a key part of it. And having the ability to look at your avionics and have choices through interoperability with different things gives you the ability, and we've always believed this, and to this very day, gives you, as an aircraft owner, choices. So you can make choices for what's important to you and be able to work with other avionics in the cockpit allows you that flexibility. So if you want to, for example, get the PFD display and MFD display first, and you have 430s and 530s in your cockpit, just say, let's use that as an example, and you know you want to upgrade to an Avidyne IFD one day or something like that, you know that you can do it piecemeal with us. You know that you can feel confident that our platform is going to be there in the long run. We're not only going to keep with, be consistent with our form factor, but consistent with interoperability, consistent with interfaces, so that when you do to make that decision, you can feel confident that Aspen's going to be there to work. You don't have to replace your whole display system with another one because you want to upgrade to a different navigator or things like that. And so we have done that throughout the 20 years of our existence. And a lot of people like, my competition will likes to do shiny new objects. So come out with a new thing, which basically obsoletes what you had before. That's not our strategy. Now we want you to be able to be confident that when you invest in an Aspen system and your flying changes or grows or new products come out and you want to interface those products, that you're not going to have to jerk out your primary flight display system that you become accustomed to and use. So that's what we pride ourselves on. Now, not all the competition is cooperates with that all the time, but that pressure from the user community for interoperability has huge impacts on our industry. If you want to have choices and you make that known to all the avionics producers, whichever ones you want, they listen. We listen, because at the end of the day, the consumer drives it. And that's where competition comes from. If a consumer can go up to one person and say, I want you to be interoperable. I want this function. If you don't give it to me, I can get it from so-and-so. That drives so-and-so to react and provide that capability. So the consumer has power in a competitive environment. And I think sometimes our average consumer in aviation has gotten so used to being told that they have to do it a certain way, they forget how much power they have. And yeah. Aspen really was meant from the very beginning and continues to that day to empower you as a consumer to make those decisions.
Yeah, I have seen that and experienced that myself. I've always counseled people, which seems to happen a lot when I'm discussing avionics options for people who are looking at maintenance issues. Take a best of breed approach, like before anything else, take every function that you want, whether it's what's right in front of you as primary, or whether it's for navigation and a flight management system or communications or anything, any type of feature that you're looking at, autopilot, engine stuff. Look at the best that is for you, what you think works the exactly how you would like it to, and decide, are those separate companies? Because rarely will they really be one. If they are one, great, do that, and that'll solve it for you, although you're then beholden to that company. But if they are separate, the beauty of assembling that kind of federated panel, best of breed panel, is that once you've done that, you're a customer of all of these companies, and they have that challenge and obligation to work together or with whatever new thing comes along. Or they're going to eventually lose you. And it seems exactly. Like they all sing the same tune. Do you talk a lot to all those other players, the Avadines of the world, the engine monitor guys, JPI, EI, autopilot manufacturers, et cetera?
Oh, you know, that's a big part of who we are and who where our industry is coming in. I bring it back to the power of the consumer. So we talk... If we don't talk, the consumer forces us to talk. Mm-hmm. Because if you want something, if you want the IFD 540 or 440 or whichever one you choose, and you want to use that and your display system doesn't play well with it, the display person is going to lose you. You have power because you can find somebody else. And over time, or when you're doing the install. So the power of the consumer drives cost, drives price, it drives functionality, it drives interoperability, and it drives what I call attitude. It drives an attitude that the consumer is who we're making things for. We're not making them for ourselves. We're not trying to trap you. We're trying to empower you to have the decisions you make. That's what competition does. And I can't emphasize it more. I've said it since day one. I just think it's very important. I saw it in business jet avionics. I saw it in avionics in the airline world, what it would do. And I see it now in GA world. And in fact, I see it more in GA world because we got a lot of new entrants. We have new entrants into this world. Just talk about the iPad. The iPad's a new entrance in avionics in our world, right? And interoperability with that. I mean, I remember when we came out with the connected panel so you could download four flight plans into the 530. That took a lot of work because Garmin wouldn't give us that interface. So we had to design that. And now look what we have now today. You have interoperability. You take a four flight plan and dump it into any navigator today. You can have interoperability there and have that iPad. That wouldn't happen if the consumer didn't demand it. And it wouldn't happen if you only had one producer of avionics or one producer of any type of thing. And that's what competition does for you. And I'm just a huge, huge believer in it.
Yeah, I mean, here's a real example I'm going to show you right now, and it's one that's a perfect example. So this is the obviously the Mustang behind us. We switched over what we're doing with the autopilot on that, and now we've got the Trio autopilot, which is absolutely spectacular in so many of the things it does. And literally, you know, talk to you guys, Aspen, about, hey, what can you know? Is this on your roadmap? Are you planning on integrating with a company like Trio so that will this grow? Will this panel that money is already invested in actually start working better and better together just through some software updates?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's key. So especially in this world, right? I can I can, you know, we can listen and see and through use of the product, upgrade it as we go along of that product to improve its interoperability. Trio is a great autopilot. We get a lot of demand for it with our E5s. It's just been a wonderful selection. The ability to get more STCs out is extremely important in that particular strategy, working with them. But that's a great example of it. I mean, the Trio autopilot, provides a great autopilot functionality, but if it doesn't interface well with the other parts, it loses its value. But they, like us, have similar views on interoperability, and we've been working closely with them. And the E5 Trio is a fantastic pair. It just works really, really well.
Yeah. I want to show something else about an understanding of growth in the panel, because again, money's tight for a lot of people. The aircraft are so expensive right now, and then trying to modernize your panel, the ability to take that somewhat piecemeal, I think, helps a lot. And we recently, so we started with just the primary. So we had it in a single 1000 Pro, Evolution 1000 Pro, before it was Max. And then we went to the Max with that. Now, that in itself has, I'll bring up a picture of that one. What I liked so much about it is that when we're in unique situations like this, where you really have a lot of terrain going on, we, instead of having a single instrument, we were able to go top to bottom and get the most important, I think, synthetic vision view of what's happening, and it's just gorgeous in being able to look at it this way. Yeah. When we were able to grow then and go from this to then add another tube and go to a 2000, Evolution 2000 system by adding an MFD, what I have found is that for us, it's really kind of revolutionized our long distance IFR flights. This is a flight that we took recently that ended up getting ugly towards the end. This weather wasn't there when in the same position when we started. And we got the same primary navigation going on the left-hand side, but the ability to have the MFD there and to have a large screen format. I'm keeping the backup because I'm in IMC right now. So I wanted to have, that's why the backup's there, that's why the traffic's there. But having this longer range view and having weather on it and being able to be strategic in my right-hand side, I really find extremely valuable. And what happened to us in this case is, as we were coming up here, this weather was closing in almost in a pinch, and we had to figure out what we were going to do, which we eventually made, this is a showing that we'd already made a right-hand turn following Long Island, and bailed out and ended up taking an approach and landing at Plymouth, in Plymouth, Massachusetts. But those routings that you can see there and having all of that in one place was really, really helpful. I want to thank you for the ability, because I don't think I would have been able to start with a two displays. I wasn't someone who was a customer of like, oh, I'm going to do a G500 or I'm going to do whatever. They were so expensive to have all that. Instead, I grew to there, and just want to kind of show you that story of something that happened literally 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and you know, that's the story of how we built this architecture. You know, we get a lot of inquiries about, why don't you go to a larger screen? Why don't you do this, do that? In particular, with the form factor that we have, and the reason that we have our form factor, and we are looking at future form factors, and I'm sure you'll be asking about what's coming up next for us. But the reality is, this allowed people to expand their systems in definition, just like you just defined. We are getting people that put in a PFD in 2009, and in 2024, they're putting in an MFD. And what's driving a lot of that MFD addition is the interfaces with these next generation navigators, and having stuff in front of you and things like that. And the Max upgrades are a lot driven by the brighter display, bigger fonts, as well as the synthetic vision angle of attack capabilities. So there are a lot of reasons why one would want to upgrade to a Max. So those are the things that we try to do. We try to provide a path that allows individual customers to find out what's important to them. Now, there's no question that a PFD-only airplane versus a PFD-MFD, having that extra MFD and IFR I fly myself. I mean, I am IFR pilot. Having that other MFD in front of me, right next to my PFD, as opposed to having to move my head to turn to look in the middle of the cockpit when I'm in an approach in the clouds, it reduces my just, or, you know, all the spatial things that happen to you when you start moving your head. So I learned that as an IFR pilot, I liked having that MFD in front of me. Somebody might think differently. Maybe it's not a big deal to them. So each of those different things, and it's all about choices, like we've said all along, it's all about consumer power to make choices. And that's the additive of the MFD and the different windows and being able to configure for different phases of flight. That's all part of our strategy. And a lot of it comes from feedback from pilots that use our stuff. The early day feedbacks that we got from the PFD when we came out, we changed a lot of things. We did a lot of things differently in the MAX because of feedback that we got. And the whole time evolution of it, if you don't mind, I'm gonna tell a little story about this. So I always, when we first came out, those of you that remember us that came out, we had to have pitot heat, right? We had to have a pitot system. And so when you lost pitot heat, you would red X. And the reason for that was back in 2007, everybody didn't have GPSs. Today's PFDs use GPS correction for, so if you lose, you know, part of your, if you lose your pitot system and stuff like that in your AHARs, you can use the GPS to provide an attitude picture, an attitude thing. Well, back then, a lot of people didn't have GPSs, so we wanted them to have that capability. A lot of backcountry people and other people came back to us and said, guys, I can't lose my, if I lose on pitot heat and I'm in the backcountry, I can't lose my attitude. So we started injecting the GPS that was in our RSM to correct that. So now you don't have to have pitot for it. But mm-hmm. today, almost everybody has a GPS in their airplanes that will put our system in. Not 100%, but a good part of them. And now we use the GPS both on the from the navigator and our own GPS. Now you got a dual system. So even if your navigator fails, you still got a GPS and you have an attitude solution. So those feedback and those things that come back to us make us change the design as we go along. And, you know, I always use that story because the backcountry guys didn't like it. They really did not like the possibility of their pitot heat going down. They didn't like it. They made it known really hard to us, and we made the changes.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question that there's probably not a very easy answer to, but When you're getting in and you're breaking barriers down and the FAA is early days listening to a lot of new technology and products, how do you, as a company, survive and then thrive as the regulations get easier, as new entrants come in, playing on a different playing field?
So this is one of the things I love about our industry. So I did in my 40 some odd career, I did spend 2 years outside of aviation running Honeywell's Industrial Automation Control, which is basically controls for oil refineries. Interesting enough, by the way, as a side note, the controls for an oil refinery are much like the controls of an autopilot airplane. They have an outer loop, inner loop, they just have different variables. But what I learned there is that because it was unregulated, it was self-regulated, you didn't, when you tried to bring new things to market, you didn't have the support and the ability to use the industry's knowledge. In aviation, we have groups like GAMA, Generation Manufacturers Association, and others, EAA and AOPA, that band together to create an interface with an always changing regulatory environment to be able to bring innovative products. That all those groups have helped me, just like they've helped my competition. But what they've done is that they've allowed or given us a path to work through the regulatory, I was going to say nightmare, I shouldn't say that, because I actually like the regulatory bureaucracy, I'll call it, with changing people. Remember, the FAA is changing people all the time. It's changing administrators. There's different priorities. I can't tell you how many priorities we've gone through and the number of people we've worked with. But the common sense force is that these organizations bring all of us together, and when new innovation occurs, they support it regardless of who it comes from. and the FAA and regulatory officials listen to them because of their vast experience as well as their influence and knowledge about our industry. And so those organizations are key to our ability to navigate that regulatory environment. And it makes it easier for companies like us. We're a startup. I mean, why would the FAA listen to us, right? Why would they listen to us? They listened to us because we had the backing of GAMA and AOPA and EAA to bring this technology to play. And they do it for all of us. And I think that is the driving force and the differentiator about our industry versus any other industry.
So tell me then, and also help understand where the product's going, where the evolution product is going, because you were a disruptor at that time, and you had the benefits of changing and evolving guidance and acceptance of things that probably, you know, big old Honeywell and some of the other guys that we used to work for looked at and were like, I can't believe they're allowing that. And then you get certified. Well, now we're in another world. You've got the same product that's made it to this point in terms of not really the same, it's evolved, you've got the Max, but similar foundation. And now there's a new entrance and a new bar. How do you keep up? How are you going to continue to keep up?
It's a good question. My customers continue to ask me that. It's a very, very sometimes tough question, right? We want to stick to our strategies and who we are in terms of allowing upgradability and interoperability. And that oftentimes has driven us to using the same form factor for quite some time. And new form factors have come out. Both Garmin and UAvionics have come out with some really cool equipment on the smaller size that has a really good applicability. Do we want to move that direction? Do we want to provide a product like that? We got on the upper end, we've got these beautiful, bigger displays that have advantages on the displays, but have some disadvantages on other parts of it in terms of backups and things like that. Do we want to move to a larger screen format? Do we want to provide touch screens? Big debates about touch screens, right? And we have that all over the place. Is a touch screen and turbine is going to work? So we're looking at all those sorts of things while still staying to our core. Because one of the things we are going to announce at Oshkosh is our ability to interface with engine instruments. So we're going to announce a partnership with EI Instruments on next Tuesday at our press conference. So
now we're getting into the good stuff, John.
there's big demand right now, right? There's a huge demand as people are getting more sophisticated about managing their engines, right? I mean, I fly a 182 that has the old gauges and has a single display for CHTs and EGTs, and I fly in a very high hot environment when I fly this 182, and it's tough. You know, you worry about the engines, and it's a fairly new engine in this plane that I use, and it's, you makes you nervous. I want an engine instrument to things, so people are paying attention to engines, and so we're gonna, with a partnership, provide capabilities to display that on our current platform. However, in order to stay competitive as a company, we have to look at larger display platforms. You know, we've decided not to go down into the single instrument things that we have, that we're seeing in the attitudes and stuff like that. I always joke about, people talk about our font, I worry about those kind of fonts too. And I've flown those, and they're great pieces of equipment for what they are. But, you know, as Aspen, we want to stay to our core, continue to provide additional functionality, upgrade our hardware. That's what the Max was. That was fundamentally why we did that, for later display technologies, allows to do a lot more displays, cooler things with synthetic vision, stuff like that. We've got a bunch of Class 3 aircraft that are waiting for us to upgrade to the Max. That's certainly coming for us. So we're going to do that. But at the same time, we're experimenting and looking at different things. One of the cool things that we have is, you probably know, we merged with six other companies to create the Aero Group. And one of the parts of the Aero Group is an eVTOL company called Jaunt Air Mobility. We're going to provide avionics for that. You just have to look at other eVTOL cockpits to kind of guess, without me having to say it out loud, the direction that we're going, that will then be brought back into general aviation. Because at core, Aspen is a general aviation company. We always will be. We always be there. And Aero gives us more money to invest in those sorts of things. So as teasers of things that we're looking at, we're going to continue on with the Aspen line that we have, the Evolution line, adding functionality, adding interfaces and things like that, and living to our core. But we're going to move and have other types of display formats as we go forward, and we're going to pick and choose when we do those and how we introduce those. But those you can expect to come back into the general aviation platforms.
That's I love that. And yeah, to anyone out there that at least I can interpret that code word of looking at urban air mobility, look at any one of the brochures for an urban air mobility and the size of those displays. And if anything like that is going to be coming from Aspen, we've got some big things to come to
and,
say.
And honestly, it's some would say it's overdue. Some would say that. Some would say we should have done that. But we've tried to stay core to who we are with our current evolution platform. We don't want to abandon that, or even, it's not even abandoned because we never, I don't want people to think that we might abandon that, because they've made long-term investments in us. Mm-hmm. And they are incredibly important customers to us, especially the early ones, because we had some difficulties in the early days, like most companies do, and they stuck with us and lived with us. And, you know, in those early days, we had some issues, and the MAX comes out. And we're so excited about our MAX platform and its reliability, and the numbers have come in, that one of the announcements we're going to make at Oshkosh is that when you buy a MAX today, you're going to get a 3-year warranty, not a 2-year warranty. Wow. Nobody else in aviation's done that. That's how much confidence we have in that MAX platform. So these are the kind of things that we want to bring to the consumer base.
Wow. I don't know anyone doing a 3-year warranty in GA aircraft. That's pretty impressive.
I anticipate that once we do it, there will be others that will follow.
Yes, that is again another like set the standard, because you're best of breed. You force other people to kind of respond to that. I want to go a little bit more into the engine side of things though, because you teased that one out, and that's huge. I mean, if again you look at the explosion in aircraft ownership, and with that comes upgrades, and with the cost of engine overhauls and things like that, people have to pay a lot more attention to it. Now I literally just had a customer recently, a client that I was advising, that finally put an engine monitor in their aircraft. And as soon as they did, found out that their engine temps had been way off the chart where they should be. And you know, so many aircraft out there just come with an oil temp gauge. And so this is critical to do. And if you're going to be able to have that now through one of your displays, that's mm-hmm. going to be a big deal. Are you able to say anything about who you're working with or how it's going to work?
We will announce a partnership with EI Instruments, and there will be announced at the press conference for those of you out here. Get a little sneak peek. I like to do that on these. Jeff gives me the opportunity to do that, and I try to do that and also reward those that actually listen to these things and listen to what I have to say, which is always amazing to me. But at the end, there will be partnership with the EI Instruments. In fact, we will have a beta working version at our booth at Oshkosh. So you can come down, take a look at it, see what it looks like, ask questions, give us feedback, that kind of stuff that we will have at our booth. So we ask, you know, those of you that come to Oshkosh, come by, see us, take a look at it. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear it.
So I can tell you the of all the, you know, comments flying in and questions I'm getting and things like that, that one of the biggest things that's going to be coming is people who are already customers are going to, you know, want some appreciation for already being a customer, to being able to upgrade to things like that when the time comes. If they go to add another, I assume another tube in order to support something like that, another unit that they're able to be helped.
Yeah, well, we obviously want to sell more units, right? So for those that only have PFDs, it might be a reason why they might add an MFD or something like that. For those that already have them, you know, the multi-displays, it'll be another feature that they can choose to when they see it. That oftentimes it's when you put in a new engine. Oftentimes that's when people want to put engine instruments in there. And if they already have an Aspen system, it'll be a more cost-effective way for them to do that. So again, choices. Consumer has the power.
Are you also looking at additional kind of venturing into other areas, whether it be as a remote unit or whether it be as something else that are sources? It comes to mind is like, you know, transponders, radios, stuff like that, that you can then control from the display?
So that's another question that we get a lot of. And a lot of that is driven by the person we're working with. So some people are more willing to work with us than others are. What we don't want to do is add cost to the cockpit. So for example, for us to With all the new transponders of ADS-B come out, we, you know, we were tied real close to the L3 Lynx, which I still think is one of the best transponders out there, both from a display and usability standpoint. So we probably won't play in the transponder. A lot of questions about nav radios. Can we control the nav radios? You know, that's been often the realm of the navigator or the FMS in the middle, but not everybody puts two of them in. So being able to control the second radio or being able to control the radio from the displays as opposed to the panel, we're always looking at that. Now, as we get into more integrated systems in the eVTOL, absolutely, that will be controlled from the display system, like you see in many of the more sophisticated higher end aircraft that you know the jets and the higher end aircraft. Absolutely, that will come. We want to pick the right ones because, you know, if we spend a lot of time on something that's not super value add to a consumer and we want to charge for it, we hurt ourselves, right? Because we want to lower costs, we don't want to increase costs. So a lot of it depends on the type of thing, but navcoms more so than transponders, because I believe transponders are pretty good right now.
Yeah.
And things like that. Navcoms would be an interesting thing to look at. Autopilot controls are very interesting things to look at, and you've seen that expand tremendously, our ability to control things. We came out with the DFC-90 interface when Avidyne first came out with it, and being able to control pretty much everything from the Aspen display was very useful. And so you'll see more of that, and we'll be looking for opportunities for that. That requires cooperation from the autopilot vendor.
Yeah.
Some cooperate, some not so much.
Well, and, of course, that's the big problem.
I mean, that's the requirement.
Yeah. I know you've done Genesis and S-Tech, Avidyne, DFC, and that does seem like such a natural, right, to set your altitude, to set your
head. It is, and autopilots are becoming more and more needed, right? And these digital autopilots. We also do the G600, for example, autopilot. Obviously, the missing one is the G500. Well, we can't get the interfaces. So, you know, if we were provided the interfaces, we'd go after that one because it's very popular. And that's where the consumer comes in. Consumer speaks up, says, I'm not going to get rid of my Aspen. If you want me to put that autopilot in, you need to interface with it. People listen to that. And so it just depends on that. But autopilots are, you know, these digital autopilots, the 3100 autopilot that Genesis does is a fantastic autopilot. The G600, G500 are fantastic autopilots. They're great for flying. I've flown all of them. And, but, you know, interoperability and the ability to interface is key for the consumer to be able to make choices. And so I always say, speak up wherever you can, whether it be about us or any of my competition, speak up, because that gives you choices.
Yeah. I want to raise something to people's attention related to that, because you mentioned Navcom a number of times here. Mm-hmm. And I did a story not that long ago in AOPA about this, but GPS, there was a time when we were so enamored by GPS that it almost seemed like, well, why do we have radio navigation anymore? You know, like, what's the point of that? And we are entering a time now where GPS jamming, GPS interference, GPS risks of where it's going to go in the future is so significant that I really want to call attention to how important that HSI display is that you have on the instrument there. There's so much that you can do because you've got to revert to that in many cases. If you're flying to anybody who's flown instruments recently, go do a search on where the GPS outages are and where you're going to have to use radio navigation and make sure you're polished up, because this does make it work very, very easily. You can see in the bottom half of the left display.
Yeah, I actually think the challenge of GPS jamming and spoofing is it's an upcoming technology challenge for us. One of the Aero Group divisions, we have a drone division, and we operate several of our drones in GPS jammed areas, and being able to bring that technology eventually into general aviation where it would be a smooth transition would be an interesting thing to do, right? I mean, you look at the technology in drones that have to operate in GPS jammed areas now, you know, we have some technology that we're looking at in that area and doing that. But at the end of the day, flying GA aircraft is all about redundancy. You got to have choices. You got to have plan B, plan C. Radios are a very, very good plan B if you relied on GPS solely. Those of us been, those of you that have been flying out there a long time actually may sometimes think it's the other way around. The GPS backs up the radios, right? And but whatever you have, redundancy, if you're a, you know, if you're a pilot like myself who flies in areas and we don't fly every day into Class B airspace or in IFR conditions, or we're flying in the northern Arizona with, and we have a GPS outage and there's two VORs out there, you better have a plan B. And radios are a great plan B, and I think the FAA is doing it in a smart fashion where they are picking and choosing those VORs or other radio-based navigation carefully. And I know that's a big debate too, and there are probably people out there who think they've gone too far. I think they're thinking it through because, again, to protect our world of GA, which nobody else in the world has, safety is paramount, right? You gotta have safety. And safety is all about having plan B, plan C, and plan D, and having the training and the equipment to be able to use it in whatever circumstance that comes out. And that's important. So, and I believe the NAVCOMs are part of that equation.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. And I do love the way that, how easy they are to use. Again, it's very, very, I find it at least incredibly intuitive. The buttons are right on the bottom of what you're looking at, and right above them is what their frequency is, what their identifier is, what you're pointing at, how you're getting there. And then of course there's the detail, you know, how far you are away from it or anything else. And it's easy to fly a magenta line when you get used to it over and over again, but all of a sudden if there's a problem with that, this is all you've got.
Yeah. Very true. And I think that's key. Oh, you mentioned something about the knobs and the you know, that's a big part of avionics, right? I mean, you go from avionics manufacturer to access different information, requires different kind of button pushes or touchscreen stuff. That is all, which is always a challenge when you're flying, you know, you move to different aircraft, different avionics. The idea there is keep it as simple as possible with the least amount of button pushes or knob turns for critical information like that. And that is really learned by the pilots who use your stuff and the feedback that they give you. And, we feel like we have a very good solution in that particular area. We get a lot of positive feedback on the knobs and the buttons on the bottom, in particular around the HSI.
Yeah, that's very, very true. So the biggest things that are on people's minds, just to kind of confirm and wrap up from your message and also what you've got announcing coming up, first of all, is you remain committed to this display version with all the new things coming. This is something. Tell us, give us that statement of what's going on with, you've got Aero, you've got a lot of things happening. People want to know what's Aspen's commitment to general aviation still at this point, and in addition to that, what's the life of this platform going to be?
Yeah. So those are excellent questions. We get them a lot. Okay. When we announced the merger with six other companies about 2 years ago, there was a lot of question, you know, what is Aspen going to do? How is it going to evolve? Is it me now? We're not going to be paying attention to general aviation. Probably the biggest message you can have is that Aero has an advanced avionics division that is separate and separately funded, and that's Aspen. And Aspen will grow. We'll grow organically and inorganically. We'll be looking for all kinds of ways to grow. What the big message that the Aero Group should send to all of my customers is that we will be able to have access to more resources to bring more functionality and more things to the market quicker. The small company has disadvantages, right? I mean, we only have so much resources and it takes time to certify. And that makes it hard to compete against the bigger guys who have more resources and can bring out multiple products in a short period of time. I think you're gonna see that at Aspen over the next 2 to 5 years. We'll be updating our product more often, coming out with new products more often than what you're accustomed to in the past because of access to resources. Our commitment to the Evolution platform is really our bread and butter. It is who we are. And so those of you that have invested and are going to invest in the Evolution should remain confident that that platform is how we're going to, we're going to stay not only with it, but we're going to expand it and move it forward, keep its hardware updated, add functionality, change things that you bring to us, whether it be fonts or whatever. We're going to continue to do that with each version that we provide and improve its interoperability. That's key for us as Aspen and as part of Aero. The other thing that I think it should be clear and you'll be seeing in the coming years is our access to technology. So whether it be out of the drone market space or whether it be out of the eVTOL or training, we're going to see those technologies seeping back into the Aspen platforms in a much more rigorous fashion because of our access to that internally. And so those things are, you know, that's who we are, and that's what, you know, we need to be very clear about. And we'll be trying to be very clear about that in our communication at Oshkosh and going forward, so that there's no doubt if somebody wants to buy an Aspen, that Aspen is a key focal point of the Aero Group and is a key focal point to keep our consumers happy.
That's great. And you know, another area I want to point out, because you have been so responsive always about customer needs and where the pain points are for the industry, is about installation. When you launched back in 2007, the thing that kind of blew my mind at the time was at least that the physical installation was so simple from a panel perspective, and that it was designed that way. They didn't have to go through all the cost and expense of a new panel. Having just done an installation, two of them actually, on Aspens, I will say that you've also come a long way when it comes to like the wiring and the harness and the fact that you can get the remote sensing module, the RSM, can come with the cable that runs through the whole plane and is ready to get pinned out to the unit, as well as things like if you want flush mount, you offer those types of things. Is there more on the horizon that can help at a time when avionics shops are so backed up, are charging so much money to do installations? Where is that on Aspen's radar about how can we make the money that they give us to sell them a unit in a box not ready to be doubled or tripled at the install shop?
Having been an aircraft owner, I know that pain. It is a big pain to buy something, a unit, only to find out the installation costs are much higher than you actually paid for the unit. So we work with a lot of dealers. Dealers are very busy right now. They've always been busy. The demand for dealer shop space for avionics mods is always very, very competitive. COVID, we lost a lot of dealers and they left the market for whatever reason. And now we're trying to claw back as an industry there. The key there is the dealers. Dealers will listen to us about installation stuff if the consumer complains about it to the dealer. Mm-hmm. If there's a rush of people saying, I don't understand why I got to spend all this money on an installation, most dealers will listen to that and talk to us. We've had really good relationships with a lot of dealers throughout the world, and it played into how we started the initial design, and it played into the whole wire harness and how that wiring is going to go. There's a lot of emphasis on that right now because of the cost of ripping out old wire and putting in new wiring and the amount of labor that takes. That's a big focus right now. But yeah. I think you even see now, you know, where people are more willing to redo their panels, redo the whole panel, you know, change the aesthetic of the panel and stuff like that. A lot of that was driven by people going to dealers and saying, you know, I can put these two Aspens in here and it is insulation costs, but if I want to redo my whole panel, it costs five times as much as putting in an Aspen. That changes the way a dealer looks at it, and that flows back to the manufacturers, whether it be Aspen or anybody else. So again, as I've used this theme and this forum to explain, to emphasize, speak up. I mean, if that's a big part of it, the industry will listen and modify, and it'll come back to our manufacturers. Companies like Aspen, and I would suggest my competition as well, we're out searching for those efficiencies for the consumer. And it's a lot easier when we hear back to the consumer than having to guess what the consumer wants. So continue to speak up. And I think you're going to see more innovations in that particular, both on the dealer side and on the aircraft manufacturer side.
Yeah. Well, I think that from an installation perspective or upgrade perspective, we always have dealers themselves, which are generally avionics shops. We've got regular shops, AMP shops, you know, mechanical shops, and then you've got the owners themselves. And the more that we can push and make available to do from the mechanic side, to do from the even the owner side, if it's a software update, the more that we can utilize all channels, I think the better it is for everybody. Even though all channels are stressed right now, it still helps. So are you looking into all that beyond the
deals? You know, the changes with in the regulatory, a lot of that is regulatory, right? Not all of it, but a fair number of it is regulatory. So you saw things come out like the E5 and the G5 and Dynon's D10 and other things that safety enhanced equipment regulations allowed more for installations by A&P people, as well as aircraft owners. I think you're going to see more of that going forward because the FAA is open to those ideas, and aircraft manufacturers, you know, if you think about it, we want throughput, right? If I'm constrained by dealers as being the only way to install my equipment, and there's only so much amount of dealers out there, smaller players get constrained by the bigger players for sure, and it hurts us. So for us, it's to our benefit to open up more channels for installation of our equipment using within the course of regulatory framework and stuff. So you are going to see more of that. It's a slow moving animal though, because of the regulatory, but it took a long time to get, and I give a lot of credit to Dynon on the D10. They kind of led the way on that. They introduced that idea of their backup on the D10 and did a fantastic job. They opened the door for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And we walked through that door and added more things to it. And so it takes time, but I think you're going to see more of that, because that's the way companies like ours can thrive, is by multiple channels. So it's actually a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think you'll see more and more of that.
That's really good. I think it helps, again, anything an owner can do to do an update, as long as it's not going to brick a unit, helps. Anything that can take pressure off the system helps and increase competition. I was just speaking with an avionics dealer recently who was basically lauding working with Aspen, because it's easy for people to become an Aspen dealer if they're qualified. And to do that, you're not, there's a different approach, because there's another manufacturer out there that wants to see fewer dealers making more money, keeping them happy, more throughput at fewer dealers. That doesn't help the consumer, because the consumer can't get their plane in the shop and gets exorbitant quotes. It seems like you've had a very open approach to dealers.
We try to. I mean, all dealers are not the same, and we love all of our dealers, but we do. That was a differentiator for us, because again, it's all about channel. If I can just, for people with the business aspects, but it's all about channel to your product to the consumer. If I can open up those channels, if through reliable, safe, and customer-friendly dealers, and a lot of these guys, little guys, are the new dealers coming out. They're really hungry, and right. They do a lot of good stuff for the consumer. That's how we've always felt that, and we will continue to feel that way. Obviously, there's requirements of a dealer to make sure they do things right, and you know, we turn dealers over if in certain circumstances if there's issues with installs and stuff like that. We keep a close eye on it. But generally speaking, we absolutely believe in that.
Yeah. So as we approach the top of the hour, the Aspen's got, you'll be in the hangar, you'll be out with the tents and lots of stuff going on. I know there's announcements of people can see it all on the website. And also we're listing it all on Social Flight about who are the social media people, the other famous people that'll be at your booth at different times. And your press conference, the big highlights, as I understand it, it's going to be aero stuff. You want to cover a few of the big ones for us?
Yeah, we'll be talking. We'll give some people update on the aero group, because people are interested in that. And we have several places that play in our eVTOL environment, our drones environment, and even our training environment. We do a lot of military. So we'll give a quick update on that. We will then go into the specifics of the relationships that we have for the engine instruments. Our extended warranty program, which we're very excited about, and our specials. We have we've been running a special for our 20-year anniversary, which is basically 20% off of most of our stuff. We think it's a great opportunity for people who are thinking about it to pull the trigger, whether they want to upgrade, move to add an MFD, or whether they want to add a new system. There will be different types of discounts for each one of those. It'll be valid to July 31st. And so we'll go through those with everybody, and then, you know, answer questions. And, you know, we invite everybody to come out. We're in Hangar B, booth 2145, where we've been for many, many years. And we look forward to seeing everybody there. Oshkosh, I'm flying in with a good friend of mine, former CEO of Jeppesen, Mark Van Tine. We're flying in his Sportsman this year. and Oshkosh, which is one of my most favorite things to do. And that little sportsman's equipped with a couple Aspens. And we love flying into there. Mark's just a great pilot and a great guy. So we'll be flying in. We have an aircraft display area out by our tent in the North 40. For those who don't know it, we sponsor the North 40 parking for the Bonanzas and Cessnas Oshkosh, and as well as helping anybody out there that camps out there. If you're flying in camping, come to our tent. We'd love to do whatever we can do to help you, make things easier. We have air-conditioned areas for those days that are really cool, really hot, and to cool you off, as well as refreshments. So we welcome you all out there as well.
Awesome. Well, John, we've reached the time of the hour where we do something that we call Social Flight's Fast Five, where we ask you some questions where people can get to know you in five quick questions. And is that something you're up for tonight?
Sure. That's always fun. I love doing it.
All right. John Usakai, this is your Social Flight Fast Five. And we're going to start with question number one. You have flown a lot of different cool airplanes. You've had a chance to be in many and quite a story past of doing some aviating yourself. What is, well, I guess, the aircraft that's kind of dearest to your heart when you think about ones that you've flown in recently or in the distant past?
Okay, so my favorite flying experience is I have an hour's time in a P-51. I got to do that about 7 years ago. I have pictures of it. I have video of it. It's one of the coolest things. It's unimaginable how cool it is to be in a P-51 as a passenger, but be able to get to fly it is just the most coolest thing. So, and I love P-51s. They're my favorite aircraft of all time. I love the way they sound. I love the way they feel. I love everything about them. So that's the coolest thing. I will tell you that my heart is still with a DA-40. I had a DA-40 for almost 10 years. It was the last aircraft built in Austria, which was another cool thing about it. And I just loved it. The only thing I like about it is in Arizona, the canopy was pretty hot. So those are probably two airplanes I'd single out in the answer to that question.
Two canopy aircraft, but you looked past it with the Mustang, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Believe me, the heat coming off that engine and inside, you forget about the heat coming from the sun.
Exactly. All right, question number two. Was there a moment in your flying that was either especially challenging, perhaps, a scary moment in some way, something that you learned a lesson from that comes to mind?
Yeah, so I will tell you that probably the biggest lesson I learned was on a flight to Oshkosh. I just got freshly minted in my with my IFR rating. I was flying by myself, and I was flying in out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And I hear on the radio as I'm in the clouds about tornadic action in the clouds about 30 miles from me. And I was never so scared in my life. And I immediately found an airport and landed. I was shaking. And what I learned is that I think I need to do a little bit more research on weather before I went out. I was so excited about going into the clouds. I was so excited about it. I just launched immediately away without doing a good weather briefing. If I would have, realized that there was some really unstable air just south of me and it was moving in my direction, and I would not have taken off. That's probably the biggest lesson. And now when I ever go, you don't fly in the clouds too often in northern Arizona because you either got ice or you got thunderheads that are amazingly there. So what I learned was make sure that I check the weather and check it again and check it again. And if I'm uncomfortable, call somebody that's a pilot and ask them. That's just stuck with me every day I've flown. Even when I'm in VFR now, I double check.
That is a good lesson for anyone listening on that. That's for sure. All right. Question number three. If you had the opportunity to go back to some moment in your life, not to change things, just to be there for 15 minutes or so, get to re-experience something that was wonderful out of your past, what would that be?
That's a good question. So I have two ways to answer that. One of the biggest regrets I have is I didn't start flying earlier in my career. I had opportunities to do it and I didn't do it. And the reason for that is I've come to the realization when you start flying later in your career, later in your life, you don't have the same skills as somebody that did earlier. So there's a couple things, you know, where I had the opportunity to start flying and I passed on it because I thought I was too busy. So that's one thing. The second thing that I would love to go back with, I spent a lot of time doing avionics, most particularly in the Dassault Falcon Jet and the Gulfstream Dassault Easy cockpit and the Plainview cockpits. I didn't realize how much fun that was because they're in the middle of development. I would hop on a Falcon 900 in the middle of France and fly to Switzerland, and all of my head was inside worried about, you know, the software. And when I think back of that, man, I should have enjoyed that a lot more, because when I tell people those stories, they say, oh man, that must have been cool. You flew here, flew there. I flew to Morocco in an ATR 42. And the only thing I remember about it was the autopilot problems that we had in flying down there. And so those kinds of events, so when you get into an airplane and as you get older and you look back at it and say, dang, I wish I'd have paid more attention. So I would love to go back to those days and enjoy it just a little bit more.
Well, that sort of may lead us into question number four here. So question number four for you is, if there were one thing that you wish that you knew back in your teens or your 20s, what would you go back and tell your younger self?
One is a flying and one is a business. I certainly should have listened to my voice that I wanted to fly. I wanted to fly when I was a young kid, and I didn't come from a famous, I came from an aviation family. My father, mother, and everybody, all nine of us, there's nine of us, just so you know, in my family, all worked at Boeing and were always around airplanes, and I always wanted to fly. And I didn't listen to that voice. I wish I would have listened to it. The second thing I wish I would have listened to is part aviation, part business, is the environment of entrepreneurialism in aviation is unique. I went the corporate route, which I have no regrets, and I loved working at Honeywell, I loved working at Boeing, I learned a lot. Sperry was one of my favorite places to work, but being in an entrepreneurial environment in the Aspen environment, and what we're doing with Aero, is so rewarding and so much fun. I wish I'd have known that, because I probably would have went that path in aviation earlier in my career.
That is fascinating. I love that. Definitely. All right. And our last question in Social Flight's Fast Five, question number five, if you could choose anyone alive or dead, anywhere in the world, anywhere in history, or someone in your personal world, if you could choose anyone to spend an evening with and get to spend some time with, who would that be?
Okay, so that's an easy one. It's Gene Cernan. Gene Cernan, who was the last man on the moon, became an Aspen customer with his 421, and got to know our customer base, and we did a couple things. Got to know him. He's an amazing man. I mean, those of you that out there that are old enough to remember the Apollos and what it was, that multiply that by a million to meet somebody who's been there that has the experience and has the depth of knowledge and the personality of a guy named Gene Cernan. He is the guy for me in my life and in my career that I wish I would have spent a lot more time with him. When he passed, it was a very sad day for everyone, but for those of that knew him and could talk to him, he was one of the most humble people around. He certainly had confidence and an ego that you'd expect an astronaut, but he was a humble man that loved aviation and he loved everything about it. He just loved being around it. He would be that person.
Wow. That is a wonderful, wonderful answer. And I am just, I'm grateful that you got to spend some time to get to know him. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, John Uzukai, thank you so, so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. And I cannot wait to see you and attend that media conference at AirVenture.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jeff. I always enjoy these things. These are fun things to do, and I hope it was fun for everybody else. And again, please come see us at Oshkosh, even if you just want to say hello. We love to talk to people, so you're always welcome. Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it greatly.
Thank you. And by the way, to everybody out there, we will also be there. You can find us all over the show and certainly spending some time at the Aspen booth. And we are running our Snag Some Swag competition, where if you flag us down and we happen to have some stuff with us, we have a ton of giveaways. And so it's a great opportunity just to meet and hang out and get a little something to take home for yourself. as well. Again, John, thank you so, so much for joining us. I look forward to seeing you next week.
Yeah, thanks. We'll see you.
Take care. And to all of you, thank you for everything that you do for General Aviation. And I hope we do get to see you next week at Air Venture. Now, after Air Venture, of course, we are off from Social Flight Live next week. You'll see some video content up from us during the week as we visit Aspen and so many of our other partners and show you some of the sights and sounds of the show to try to take you there if you couldn't be there in person. And then we are back on Tuesday, July 30th, with our friend Ariel Tweedo from Flying Wild Alaska. Her father, as you may know, passed away this past year. We're going to do a wonderful show talking about her family and celebrating everything that the Tweedo family has done in Alaskan aviation and beyond. So it should be a lot of fun and a nice re-entry from Air Venture Week. Until next time, I'm Jeff Simon for Social Flight. Blue skies.